The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. This week...
Of course, we have prepared for no deal. And tomorrow, the Cabinet will be discussing the next phase in ensuring that we are ready for that scenario.
What we are doing is putting contingency plans in place. What we will do is have 3,500 service personnel held at readiness, including regulars and reserves, in order to support any government department on any contingencies they may need.
Never mind Christmas, it's Project Fear +++ as Theresa May puts troops on standby, buys thousands of fridges and retreats to her bunker to prepare for the Brexit apocalypse. As business leaders, her own MPs and the rest of the world watch on in horror, we ask if May would ever really take the nuclear option. Also this week, with Parliament in deadlock, should the issue of Brexit be decided by the public instead? And how are MPs planning to avoid thinking about Brexit over the Christmas break? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, faced with the prospect of defeat for the meaningful vote on her Brexit deal, Theresa May's cabinet decided to dramatically step up preparations for a no-deal Brexit. Project Fear looked like a walk in the park compared to the new measures, a further $2 billion on Brexit preparedness funding, becoming the world's number one buyer of fridges to stockpile medicines, and putting 3,500 armed forces personnel on standby. So, is all this just an obvious ruse to frighten MPs into voting for a deal? Or is there a very real chance that we could crash out of Europe? Well, I'm joined to discuss all of this and eat some mince pies by my expert panel, The Guardian's Raphael Baer and Susanna Rustin, and Katie Balls from The Spectator. Raph, this has escalated quite quickly.
Yeah, it really has. I think it's possible that the Prime Minister and most of the Cabinet sort of legitimising the idea of leaving the EU with no deal in this way, as she has done in the past with her talk of sort of no deal is better than the bad deal, might really go down as one of the biggest strategic miscalculations a Prime Minister has committed for a very, very long time. Just because we understand, as you said, the function of it is to sort of spook people a little bit, and also to signal to, I suppose, the European Union that we're serious about leaving with no deal, and to make the sort of ERG hardline leavers feel that actually that is an option and therefore the Prime Minister's listening to them, and then you can sort of busk it out a little bit and somehow in this, through by this gambit, it's supposed to turn into people voting for the deal. What it seems to be achieving to me is to normalise as part of the reasonable repertoire of things that might happen, something that really, really shouldn't happen. I mean, there's no question really in my mind that in practice, leaving the European Union without, you know, just basically ripping up the legal framework on which the UK has done commerce, diplomacy, and everything with its largest trading partner and continental allies for 40 years, and incinerating all the diplomatic goodwill involved, it's the behaviour of a rogue state. I mean, it's such a bad idea, and yet it's also the default setting if you get to the end of March without the withdrawal agreement that looks pretty much like the one May's done one way or another being ratified by Parliament. So it could happen, and running around telling people it might well happen makes it more likely to happen.
Katie, there's a sort of division, I guess, of the reasons that the Cabinet have about why you should announce this now, that some people have got different views about why that should be.
Yeah, I think there's lots of different motives around the Cabinet table, and there's many ministers who feel like this is a bit late to have started hyping up or, you know, going faster with the no-deal planning. I think there's some ministers, you know, Matt Hancock, he keeps talking about all the fridges he's bought for Christmas and for the UK, and privately, those around him say that he is not someone who wants to go anywhere near no-deal. So I think when he's talking up the preparations, that's not, I think, to suggest that this is the best way forward. He's also someone who, back in one of the previous cabinet meetings, when they talked about the final Brexit deal position, made the warning that he couldn't guarantee in a no-deal Brexit that people wouldn't die. So I think sometimes with some of this planning, it really depends on the department, how okay they think no-deal is. Michael Gove campaigned for Brexit, but since moving to DEFRA, he's been made to realise that no deal he doesn't think for his department is really that doable, because it would affect rural areas very badly. But then you have some ministers who are much more bullish, and I think often that is because from their departmental perspective, no deal opens more opportunities.
So then, do you Do you think that it's something that MPs will buy as a way to, I guess, frighten them into voting for the deal because the alternative looks so terrible?
No, I don't think so. And I think this last week has gone really badly, if that's what the government was hoping. I think it's created a really quite chaotic and alarming atmosphere, as if we really are in danger of going off the rails. And some of the talk about fridges and so on, it sort of has this slightly hysterical edge, which could almost seem comic if it wasn't so tragic.
And Penny Mordaunt's talked about a managed glide path for Brexit. And we hear people talk about this idea of a managed no deal. You know, it's quite hard to pin down what that means and whether this, you know, getting the armed forces on standby is part of having a managed no deal. Is there such a thing?
No. Sorry, I mean, we have to be really clear about this, right? First of all, it doesn't really make that much sense to talk about any kind of no deal in a way, because one way or another, when you are not a member of the European Union, you have to have some kind of arrangement with the European Union regarding what goes in and out of the single market, what goes in and out of the customs union, medicines regulation, nuclear materials regulation. Now, you can either have a comprehensive negotiated agreement, and what we've learned over the last 2 years is that the power balance in the negotiation of that comprehensive agreement, the withdrawal agreement that we now have, the power balance is with the Commission, because they can organise 27 countries into quite a solid block, 27 members' solidarity, and that basically gives them leverage over the UK, which is a powerful country, but not as big as the rest of the EU. Now, if you then take that same dynamic, 27 against 1, and you put it in a situation where the UK has ripped up the negotiation that was already done, incinerated what goodwill there was left, and then is then saying to that same bloc, we would still like a lot of the things you gave us when we were having a nice friendly negotiation, but now we're demanding them, and if you don't give it to us, we will impose an economic blockade on ourselves. You just don't get, all you get is a much, much worse deal in a sort of desperate panic fire sale ad hoc way. Whereas if Theresa May had actually said a terrible deal is better than the bad deal, then people would realise the logical inconsistency of what she's talking about. So she said no deal. But actually no deal was remaining in the European Union. That was the sort of the sensible way to do no deal. What we're talking about now is literally an act of wild national self-sabotage in panic, because essentially you don't like the consequences of negotiating with the European Union as a third country.
I think the problem with managed no deal is you don't know if it works until you try it. So when you speak to those who are advocating a managed no deal, what they think is basically, ultimately in the end, people will be pragmatic. So the Brussels won't want to, you know, cut off trade or make trade more difficult for countries like France to the UK, because it would be hurting both sides. So they think if you, in a way, call their bluff, if you say we are prepared to walk away, you would have all these mini deals that would keep planes flying. Though we have this week seen the European Commission's ideas on what exactly UK planes should do in a no deal. So I think the thinking is they would come round, and actually a lot of this would be talk and you would find a solution. The problem there is that ultimately the EU is a political organisation, so they want to obviously protect the European Union to show that it is better to be in the club than outside the club. So I think although it would cause hassle on both sides to do the no-deal planning the European Commission is suggesting it would do, it doesn't mean they wouldn't do it.
And also, just to finish that point quickly, sorry to interrupt, you would get agreement, but you'd get agreement on the EU's terms. So yes, obviously it's in the EU's interest to give licenses to UK hauliers to get some stuff across the channel, but only as many as are absolutely required, and they don't actually legally have to give more than 5%. The other 95% can go to EU-based, single market-based hauliers, which obviously a lot of hauliers based in the European Union would quite like. So one way or another, it just becomes about terms being dictated by the EU to the UK in the event of a no deal, or you negotiate and we tried negotiation and we got a deal.
I think people have got used to an extent to this extremely our politics in this country being dictated by the progress or lack of progress of this very difficult negotiation over a period of time. But I also think the suddenness of the shift between sort of 9 days ago, when we were expecting for there to be the meaningful vote, and then to this, you know, sort of 4 days before Christmas, suddenly we're sort of stockpiling medicines. It does feel to me really slightly out of control. And I think everybody would like to think, you know, us, but also everyone in the country that the government sort of knows what they're doing and has got a plan and has worked out this series of options. But this week, to me, just feels really all over the place. I don't know what's going on.
And we hear that there's going to be, you know, sort of 80,000 letters sent out to businesses, you know, giving them 100 pages, packs of how to prepare for no deal. And there's going to be sort of public information campaigns about what citizens should do. I mean, do you think that is in a way something that could bring pressure on MPs from the public if you start to get a public realisation of how terrible a no deal situation could be? And does that, you know, in a way affect May's chances of getting the Brexit deal through? Do people calm down over Christmas and think, good God, maybe this isn't what we want?
Well, that depends on whether Parliament, the majority in Parliament against no deal, remains solid. I really hope it does. And that obviously some Conservative MPs are really crucial to that.
But that's part of the strategy, right?
Yeah, and I think a lot of Brexiteer MPs feel like Number 10 and the government are playing up the risks of no deal. So these no deal warnings they see as focusing on the negative, you could say, and very technical. And the idea, I mean, there's been things briefed out, like the idea that you maybe shouldn't go on holiday past, you know, you shouldn't plan a holiday past March. I mean, that does seem slightly over the top. Whatever way you look at it, I think people will be able to leave the country. But I think there is a feeling that Number 10 are using this in a political way rather than purely to show we're prepared for this. Because we have seen, as we touched on earlier, Theresa May seemed to go a bit cold on the idea that no deal is better than a bad deal. That said, if we are heading to a no deal scenario and it is currently the default, you do need to provide these, you know, this information. So I think it's a little bit of a catch-22 for Theresa May.
Yeah, my sense is that it could really badly backfire because when you speak to people who very passionately want to leave the European Union, and increasingly having the sequence of everyone attacking the deal, particularly the backstop as being, you know, trapped in vassalage and a terrible arrangement for long term for the UK, and then the switch to, okay, well then maybe no deal, against the backdrop where people just don't believe government when they say there are serious economic consequences from this, partly it's the legacy of 2016, you have this idea taking hold among a lot of leavers that actually no deal is the only thing that is a proper Brexit, and literally anything short of that would somehow be Brexit in name only, a fake, bogus, Remain-y Brexit. And that's, I just can't emphasise enough how phenomenally dangerous it is to let loose in the country the idea that if you voted leave in 2016, the only thing that truly represents an inaction of that mandate is leaving the EU with no deal. It's a staggeringly irresponsible thing for a prime minister to basically let out there.
And it's a kind of an extraordinary thing for a party, for a Conservative Party that's seen itself as the party of economic stability, the party of business. We had the warning of some five of the sort of major business groups and trade unions on the front page a couple of days ago saying what a disaster it would be, how panicked they were to see these things coming out of government, and the predictions of a sort of 9.3% hit to the GDP over 15 years if this was something that was allowed to take place. Has the Tory party got to this point where they think that kind of thing is worthwhile?
Well, I think the problem for the Tory party is they are disagreeing on what a party of competence looks like. So yeah. There are many Conservative MPs who think ultimately in the long term the backstop does not reflect their values, because they want to be entrepreneurial, they want to be able to lead the way on things, and they think they won't be able to do that under the backstop. I see wrapping his head in his hands as I say this. And on the other side, there would obviously be an economic shock if you go straight to no deal, and there are lots of Tories who do think that would be that moment, like John Major had, where the voters turn on you because suddenly they do have that, and you no longer trust the Tories with the economy. And actually, if you look at all the polling they've done since that disastrous snap election, quite soon after, MPs got summoned and presented with route maps of where they stand on values. The only thing the Tories really led on comfortably was the economics of the economy, and then they were doing okay on security. So they can't really afford to lose that. But there's also a risk that with Theresa May's deal, because so many people decried it as Brexit in name only, because some people think it is, that also really hurts some of Leave voters, and that is what they need to rely on if they want to stay in power at the next election.
Yeah, I think I'll add one thing to that, which is that the radicalisation, ideological radicalisation of Tory Euroscepticism, to the extent, you know, bear in mind that only 5 years ago, to be Eurosceptic basically meant you wanted to stay in the European Union but didn't like it much. You know, now suddenly it's become literally no connection with the institutional framework of the European Union is can be tolerated. That's quite an extreme transition. And essentially, the way I see it, you know, Brexit, it's kind of like a revolutionary movement, but it's like a revolution on the sort of 1979 Iranian model, where you have like a kind of a secular administration that goes, OK, we're going to try and do this revolution, but hold the country together. And then you have this sort of Supreme Council of Mullahs, which are like the ERG, who have this kind of basically theological, fundamentalist religious idea of what Brexit is supposed to be. And that is actually the supreme authority. So, yes, you have a sort of a secular prime minister in Theresa May who wants to do the revolution, but she's actually ultimately subordinate intellectually and ideologically now, it seems, to the sort of Ayatollahs of Brexit.
Thank you all, and we'll be paying a return visit to Brexitville later in the show. Now, some MPs have criticised the fact that politicians are about to break up for a recess of more than a fortnight, with Brexit still unresolved and just 100 days to go until Britain leaves next March. But everyone deserves a break, even MPs and peers. So we asked The Guardian's Peter Walker to ask a few of them how they'd be avoiding thinking about Brexit over the Christmas holidays, beginning with Tory MP Heidi Allen.
I am going to try and have a bit of a break because mentally, you know, this place really annihilates you, yeah, to be honest, and you have to. You don't do your constituents good service if you're exhausted all the time. But I can't pretend it won't be difficult. You know, I feel guilty that, you know, our job as MPs on any day of the week, let alone at the moment, is to make sure that we are working for our country, and we are at this desperate position, and it just feels wrong that I'm about to head off to buy a turkey, really.
Here's Labour's Wes Streeting.
I definitely want a Brexit-free Christmas. Christmas is normally the time where I do most of my reading. It's a constant frustration for me as an MP after 3 years that we actually don't get a huge amount of reading time, which probably explains a lot in terms of the quality of parliamentary debates sometimes. But summer and Christmas recesses are when I normally do most of my reading. So hopefully a good mixture of fiction and non-fiction, and definitely, definitely, definitely not Brexit.
And here's Tory MP for Mid Norfolk, George Freeman.
For me, it's partly food, both cooking it and eating it. The Christmas Western drives my children absolutely mad. And it's fine if I watch it several times and fall asleep. The Christmas War movie, we've now done Guns of Navarone about five times. Last year, I got the editor's cut of Das Boot.
Which is like about 12 hours long, isn't it?
About 12 hours long. The annual Dickens, so I read a Dickens every year. This year is The Christmas Carol.
Excellent.
Curling up beside the fire with a Dickens and a glass of whiskey. I mean, stereotypical Tory MP at Christmas, right?
And finally, Lord Norman Fowler.
Well, we again, first of all, have a family Christmas. And then a couple of days later, Fiona, my wife and myself, we're getting on a plane and we're going to Oman. I'm going to sit in the sunshine and do absolutely nothing but read novels and hope that the public relations people in the House of Lords don't get in touch with me and ask me to do interviews on here and there. I just want to get away from it.
Norman Fowler there. I think going to Oman might help take my mind off Brexit as well. That was quite illuminating. Well,
yeah, it was. I sort of sympathise to the extent that, yes, obviously it'd be nice to have a break. But all this talk about, like, let's just forget about Brexit for a while. Actually, you know what? It's only 100 days before the UK leaves the European Union. So, you know, maybe you sipping whiskey and watching a Western, important, maybe not as important as preventing the UK from having the worst political, diplomatic, economic crisis of any of our lifetimes. But that's a bit churlish. I mean, let them have their Westerns and their books.
I mean, I guess that maybe MPs sometimes do need a break in order not to... I think we saw, you know, some scenes in Parliament which were really sort of chaotic in the past couple of days. There's a sense that there's a kind of feverish atmosphere that people just really need to decompress. And do you think there's sometimes some merit in people having a break and going away to think?
I really hope so. I think it has become quite feverish. I mean, it's obviously a long term. People who've got kids always know that by Christmas everyone's sort of exhausted. It's the longest term. And you would hope that people will go away and feel a bit grounded. I mean, you know, talk to their families, the people they know in their villages and towns, their constituents, and that the atmosphere, something will change. I mean, I don't quite know what's going to make it change, but something really does need to change. So I really hope something will be different when we come back in the beginning of 2019.
Yeah, I mean, Westminster is a bubble. We all say that a lot of the time. And I do think it is important that MPs go home, enjoy a conversation that's not about high alignment or the backstop, and get a little bit of perspective, I think, going back forward. Because if you are talking to the same people, it's very easy to see why, you know, MPs get so kind of stubborn in their views. And we've seen that as the term's gone on. Everyone is exhausted because it's a hung parliament. And I know we're not going to feel sorry for MPs too much here, but because it's a hung parliament, they don't really get to leave. They're stuck there very late. And lots of the perks, if, you know, if there is a majority and so forth, are gone. And you add to that the fact that, you know, very late nights on Brexit, and it does feel like it's got to that point in the past week where lots of MPs, even in their own party, can't stand each other. So I think they do need a break.
I've been talking to some people in Downing Street, and you know, they were all sort of expressing some views over the past few days that they hope that people not only, you know, just take some time to relax, but they just get away from each other, get away from each other being able to rile each other up and egg each other on to go to for the most extreme thing possible, and that, you know, when people are slightly away from that hothouse, that they might start to think again. Do you think that, Raf, what do you think about that wishful thinking?
A little bit, but not impossible. I mean, certainly you always, as long as I've been covering sort of Parliament, you always get a new dynamic happening in January. And it's more so than over after the summer recess, because there's something about Christmas and people spending time with family, and some MPs, they'll go to church, for example, which they don't necessarily do the rest of the time. They do speak to people and meet people outside the political environment, and it gives them a slight shift in perspective. I think that is definitely true. In terms of not getting everyone's sort of backs up and sort of trying to bring the temperature down a bit, I think the most important thing is for everyone to switch Twitter off for a couple of weeks.
Absolutely. Thanks all. We'll be back after this.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Now, with Parliament in deadlock, should the issue of Brexit be decided by the public instead? Damon Albarn, the former Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams, and novelist Jonathan Coe and Ian McEwan are among prominent public figures petitioning for a citizens' assembly. They propose that 500 members of the public debate the issue and decide on a solution, an approach that helped break the impasse that led to the historic Irish abortion referendum earlier this year. On the phone we have Neil Lawson of the campaign group Compass, who organised the petition. Neil, what's the need for a citizens' assembly? Tell us about that.
Well, it's kind of drawn of two things, really. Firstly, as Parliament runs out of options about what to do and can't agree to anything, there needs to be a way out of this. We sort of urgently think that, and desperately think that, we might end up with no deal, but that shouldn't be just by default, just because the clock's run down. It should be a conscious decision of Parliament or the people or someone. On the other hand, this is just such a complicated issue. I mean, this is why government can't resolve it, why the parties can't resolve it, because it cuts across party boundaries. It's so complicated, it's so deep, and you can't come up with answers through the whipped party system or through binary referendums. This, you know, you have to kind of deliberate on this. You have to think about it. You have to see other people's point of view. You have to kind of develop your thinking and come to a new position. And that's what citizens' assemblies do. They allow people to think and look at deep, complicated issues and come up with more balanced, nuanced answers to what the problem is. And they work, and the methodology is there. So given the crisis of Brexit, why don't we use the tried and trusted methodology and apply it to this, you know, most complicated, urgent and desperate issue?
Take us through the practicalities a little bit. Like, how do you pick the 500 people? How do they get together? Do you just lock them in the room until they agree, or how does it work?
We haven't done it very much in the UK. The Work and Pensions Select Committee did a really good one on adult social care and come up with really good answers. But they've not been done much in the UK. They've been used extensively in Ireland recently on abortion and on same-sex marriage. They've been used in Canada a lot to solve a whole load of problems, not least their kind of voting system. So the methodology is there. You get a polling organisation to randomly select, you know, whatever number you want, from 100 to 500 people, and then they're filtered really rigorously to ensure that they represent the population as a whole. You then have a kind of panel of people who decide from, you know, from both sides on this Brexit, you know, from all positions, what expert evidence should be presented to the citizens, what arguments they should have, what order do you take the debate in? And then over successive weekends, you know, people come together, are given the evidence, get a chance to, with through facilitation, to debate the issues, you know, and then start to draw up their conclusions and recommendations.
And there was a petition printed in at the weekend in The Observer. And have you had a lot of response to it? What have people been saying about it?
About a huge amount of interest. I mean, there was lots of the usual practical, is there time, you know, what authority or body could do it, etc. But in terms of people just saying, yes, look, here's a really interesting, fresh, innovative way around this and through this, there's been a huge amount of interest for an idea that many people, as I say, feels quite alien and many people don't understand. So it's kind of really bubbling up. And I think the more that Parliament struggles to come up with an answer, the more people are going to look round for a solution. And this is the last one standing. And there is no good way out of the Brexit conundrum. You know, no one's going to be happy, but this is definitely the least worst way out of it.
And can you see it gaining traction in the sort of coming weeks and months? And like you say, the time is running really short. It is.
And we're thinking about the select committee route to do it. I mean, it could be the Brexit committee, if they were minded to, could sanction this and invite one of the expert professional organisations to come in and run it. I mean, it is doable. We are running out of time. There is the option, of course, across the piece on all of these, of postponing Article 50. And I think that the noises from Europe on that are that it could be extended for, you know, a month or so. Europe's worry is that you then get hooked into the European elections in May. And I think they want a Brexit decision out the way, you know, before then. So there is time, there is definitely time to do it. And it's definitely, the answer. Because it isn't just about the technicalities of whether we have no deal or a second referendum. It's the very process of people being seen to kind of empathise with each other and negotiate with each other and come up with sensible solutions rather than a kind of winner takes all binary, I'm right, you're wrong kind of approach, which is kind of really, you know, gumming up our political system at the moment.
Do you think it sort of says, in a way, something quite sad about our politicians and Westminster, that, you know, the 650 of them in the room, and they don't necessarily, you know, they've not managed to find a solution between themselves?
Yeah. This is telling us much deeper things about the culture and structure of our political system. It was kind of built for a kind of, you know, two classes, adversarial, competitive, in which the winner pulled the levers of the state in order to make things happen. And the world has moved so far on from that, you know, you can't say that everyone just fits into one of the two big party moulds, you know, issues like Brexit, but a whole host of others cut completely across the two party politics. And even if you manage to win in our system, you find out when you go and pull the levers, they no longer work, because the world out there is so complicated and so nuanced. And we don't live in the world where, you know, you can pull levers. We live in a kind of network society where everyone has a voice and everyone has a say. And that's a good thing. But our politics doesn't look anything like that at all. So this is really telling us that we need a paradigm shift, a revolution in the way we do our democracy and politics. But let's fix Brexit. But let's use Brexit as a way of showing that politics can be done better.
Neil Lawson there. Raph, is there any merit in this idea as opposed to, say, a referendum?
Look, I think there's merit in anything that's a sort of a constructive attempt to try and navigate out of this situation, because the root of the problem, I suppose, is that in 2016, you had a competition between something that was a real thing, which was membership of the European Union, which had merits and demerits and had actual terms, and then a non-thing, which was Brexit, this word, leaving the EU, a blank canvas onto which people could project more or less whatever they wanted, and then no one knew what it actually meant in practical terms to leave the European Union. That was true of Remainers as much as it was of Leavers. Parliament's stuck, as we see, and no one's in a massive hurry to relive the 2016 experience, particularly when one of the items on the ballot paper is so abstract that you can't argue about it, either for or against it, meaningfully. So yes, is there merit in something that just clarifies literally what the options are? My reservation, I suppose, is that I mean, the sort of constitutional purist in me says we have a citizens' assembly. It's called the House of Commons. So, you know, from that point of view, I think it just sounds like just another way of saying talking about processes and not destinations. And ultimately, what we really need to decide is the destination.
Right. And Katie, one of the points I made to Neil, and it was, you know, that it's kind of a sad thing, isn't it, to have to organise another citizens' assembly when that's what Parliament is supposed to do. And it would be an acknowledgement that Parliament isn't working as a system to try and deliver something like this.
Yeah, it would be an acknowledgement, but you look at Parliament and I wouldn't say that the past term has really instilled your faith in that. If you're, you know, simply because nothing's really getting through, and on Brexit it doesn't feel like anyone is changing their position on either side. It feels like you're stuck in a rut, and even when people are changing their position, so for example someone like Joe Johnson, who was in theory supporting the Prime Minister's deal, then resigns the front bench, but ultimately, he's just going back to his position in the EU referendum of Remain, because he wants to go for a second referendum. So it doesn't feel like much is moving. I think the citizens' assembly idea is interesting, but we did have a big vote the first time around. We have already had one referendum, but lots of people made their points known on Brexit. So I think if you were going to move that on, you would need really specific aims you're discussing. So if we talked about this indicative vote in the House of Commons, where MPs could, you know, show if they support a Norway-type model, Theresa May's deal, or a second referendum. And I think it would have to be almost very technical what you're discussing on this, but rather than the ideas of sovereignty versus this, it would have to be the absolute minute, very boring details. And I don't know if that's going to excite citizens across the country.
Do you think the citizens are exercised enough to want to do something like this? I mean, for a lot of people you speak to outside of Westminster, they really have just switched off.
Yes, that's a good way of, it's a good question. I think it would be worth a try. I think we obviously have got a system of representative democracy, but I think the idea of a citizens' assembly, as if it's meant to be more of a cross-section, more sort of ordinary people, for want of a better word. And I think that there would be some merit in trying to convene an assembly and having a discussion that would really try to reach some form of consensus, which would be the point, because I think the divisions have just are growing so acute and show no signs of shrinking that we need to find some mechanism. And whether there's time for it and how practical it is and how on earth we would get to there from here, I don't know, but I do like the idea.
To move on slightly, but in a similar vein of trying to build consensus, one of the things that is still up in the air as we go into Christmas recess is exactly what the Labour position is going to be on Brexit when we return in January. And quite a few people around the sort of Remainy end of the Labour Party, including the Labour for a People's Vote group, are calling for a special conference to members to be able to kind of finally set the direction, given that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't seem to show a great deal of interest in calling a confidence vote that he can't win, and knowing that when he doesn't win it, then that would entail moving on to a second referendum. So a special conference to sort of set the direction again. I mean, Raf, it doesn't necessarily sound like that would be something that the Labour leadership would go for, but how does their hand eventually get forced?
Well, yeah, I think that's the bottom line, as you sort of suggested there, is that the Labour position, I mean, is to have a general election via a confidence vote. And it's become increasingly clear that that mechanism isn't available. And besides, if you had a general election, Labour would still have to have something to say about what it wants from Brexit in its manifesto. So what has been exposed in the last 10 days in particular is that on the single biggest issue of the generation, the leader of the Labour Party doesn't actually have a coherent thing to say. And that is obviously problematic. It seems to me that sort of the big picture, the ideal Brexit outcome from sort of Jeremy Corbyn's point of view for a long time has been, if possible, to get Brexit with none of the blame for Brexit. So somehow you get to a situation where the UK is out of the European Union. You can still have a chance of forming a very radical Labour government and you're not governed by state aid rules and competition law. But Jeremy's fingerprints aren't on it anywhere. So that all the sort of younger, very Remain people, all of the Momentum people who are very pro-European, and all the kind of Jeremy Corbyn sort of that environment doesn't blame him for Brexit. And it looked for a while like he might get away with that, and now it's looking like he can't, and that he has to really choose. And ultimately, if he doesn't want to sort of to pin his colours to the mast too directly, or look like he's climbing down from the position of saying we have to honour the first referendum because there's lots of constituencies Labour need to win where people vote to leave. We all know that. The sort of the ladder that he can climb down towards, say, a referendum is going to be exactly a kind of party democracy thing. Say, if we put a consultation to the members, they would obviously say we're Remain and we want a referendum. And then that's his sort of, that's his safe passage out of the situation he's a bit stuck in.
Is there a moment where his hand sort of gets forced? What like it seems to still, we still need to think that we get to that moment time and time again, and yet there is no progress on it. Do you think there is a moment that has to, where that has to happen?
Well, I think after the vote, presuming it happens in January, I mean, I think we thought we might get to it last week, and we've got the Prime Minister to thank that didn't happen. So I think we need to wait and see. And I think there's a strong likelihood that Labour will end up backing another referendum. I think the question then obviously is what's on that referendum. And I certainly wouldn't want to see any referendum with no deal anywhere near the ballot paper. So we'll wait and see.
And Theresa May was almost mocking Corbyn yesterday for his reticence to call a confidence vote. In fact, that was the thing that led to the alleged stupid woman muttering that sent Parliament into chaos yesterday. But, you know, she was saying, you know, in a pantomime way, you know, oh, yes, he is. Oh, no, he isn't. And do you think it risks becoming a kind of comedy thing that Labour won't do it?
I think it does risk becoming a comedy thing. I think it was interesting how, I mean, from a purely political perspective, if you take up where you stand on Brexit, I think Labour have handled Brexit quite well, just because they have just let it be the Tories' problem, kind of stood by, tried not to take too bold a stance, been vague where they could be. And it felt like this week was probably the first week where Corbyn made a big misstep, and that was the confusion about what he was going to do about this confidence vote, because the day it happened was a very strange day. We were being told there wouldn't be a confidence vote. Then we were told that he was going to do one. Then when Theresa May named when this vote was going to be, which is a week before when it has to be, according to some experts, in January, they were quick to send out these Twitter banners saying, you know, a win, we forced Theresa May to name a date for the vote, so we're happy. John McDonnell went along with that line. And then about, you know, half an hour later, Jeremy Corbyn then tells the Speaker that he is going to do a confidence motion, but the confidence motion is in the Prime Minister specifically. So it is a cop-out because it means it has no force and the government can choose whether to make time for it. And it did just seem to be the worst of both worlds, because you're taking the stance and you don't have the votes to win it, but you're also taking the kind of the wimpy one, so it doesn't even have effect. And then it quickly managed to unite the Tory party, and probably for the first time in weeks, the DUP came out in support of Theresa May. So that was why she was able to be so bullish in PMQs. But the problem is, when this final deal is voted on, there's a high chance the DUP won't be supporting her. And I think that is when might be a joke which Labour can make against Theresa May.
And I think one of the things that I thought, you know, I didn't think there were that many interesting things about the stupid woman debacle which happened in the House of Commons. But one of the things I did think was interesting is how unified the Tory benches was. You suddenly had this sort of groundswell of unity there, which I hadn't seen in many, many months. And it was because there was suddenly a common enemy that's Jeremy Corbyn. And is that the key, really, for them at least, to remind them all that they actually are in the same party, and that's the way that you eventually bring the party back together again?
It is definitely the case. First of all, I agree with you that actually seeing just a palpable relief on the face of some Tory MPs that they got to feel like Tory MPs again, because they were lined up in hostility, slightly preposterous hostility to Jeremy Corbyn, if you ask me. But let's not go into that again. Yeah, ultimately, the two most charged, highly charged dynamics of domestic British politics at the moment are the fear of no deal and the fear of Jeremy Corbyn being Prime Minister. And those, between those two sort of polar forces, a huge amount of Westminster politics is decided.
Yeah, I think the Tories can agree on two things they don't like: Jeremy Corbyn and John Bercow. So it was actually a double win for them when this happened.
Right.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to see how suddenly the mood also changed against Bercow, accusing him of, the Speaker of the House of Commons, accusing him of bias. And Andrea Leadsom said, well, in fact, you've called me a stupid woman as well. I mean, despite the fact of it being a really quite ludicrous confected row, there are quite interesting underlying political things that were happening yesterday.
I think that Jeremy Corbyn is a bogeyman, really, is extremely important for the Conservatives. I think we're sort of, when it comes to the crunch, whether Conservatives will vote against the Prime Minister will depend partly on whether they are prepared to see the government fall, or at least risk that, and an election and a Labour government under Jeremy Corbyn. So I think that for him to appear, clumsy, poor judgment, everything they said about him yesterday is hugely helpful.
Last question, I guess. Is there still a way for this deal to get through? And if there is a way, can you ask all of you, what is the route to it? How do you get it there?
Well, you get a concession on the backstop, which is legally binding, and it doesn't need to involve opening up the withdrawal agreement, which I don't think there's any chance of happening. There are a few ways you could have a workaround. Are Brussels going to give Theresa May this? That remains very unclear. But I have noticed in the past week, definitely a softening amongst some Brexiteers. I think people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, they might say on Twitter they now support Theresa May. I don't think they're going to be voting for this deal, even if that concession comes through. But there is a middle group of Tory MPs who didn't want to vote for this deal, and that was partly because they felt like they would lose the support of the DUP, and that would mean an early election. So if the deal went through, the DUP could join Labour in a confidence motion, and that would start an early election. I think if Theresa May can get the DUP back on side, and that's something you've written about, Jess, too, then she can start to get this deal working to a level where she might be able to get through the Commons. But the problem is the DUP aren't going to take a concession that gives them some cover to, you know, feel proud and, you know, pretend that they've won something. They will want something legally binding. And that's a big challenge for Theresa May.
I find it very hard to see one. I did wonder whether her last throw of the dice would be to call a referendum herself and put her deal to the public rather than to Parliament, if she doesn't have the support for it in Parliament. I don't think that's very likely, but I can't see any other way.
Yeah, I think both of those are the routes. The only thing I'd add to that is, you know, when the ERG were first sort of talking about confidence votes in Theresa May, a party confidence vote, you remember they struggled to get the 48 letters in at first. I think they are that segment of the party is a little bit more biddable than they sometimes make out, and so that the Tory rebellion could come down, but it doesn't come down, and then there's the DUP factor, so it doesn't come down low enough that you don't at some point need Labour MPs to vote for this thing. And that's the bit that's really, really hard to see. That is your last act as a Labour politician if you essentially decide to throw Theresa May a lifeline in that vote at that time. And I can't see that many Labour MPs, you know, short of maybe, you know, Kate Hoey, who would be, and she doesn't look very keen either. So, yeah, there aren't many Labour MPs who are in a hurry to do that.
Thank you all. Well, that's it for this week and for this year. My thanks to all my guests, Raphael Bear, Susanna Rustin and Katie Balls. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Politics Weekly will be back on Thursday, the 10th of January. Thanks for listening and have a very happy Christmas.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.